Okay, well, good evening. So, here we go. I want to talk a little bit about apocryphal writing. Not a whole lot, but a little bit. Because a lot of Daniel is apocryphal writing. And it's really kind of word picture. It's really word picture. It's a very visual language. It's kind of a way that we don't talk. Right? We don't really speak a lot. But it was a very common thing back then. There were a lot of people that spoke this way. Greeks spoke this way. They would tell stories this way. And it really brought to the imagination a lot of different things. Wow, I just went away from that. I only wanted one copy of each one. Let's go get a book. Tried to print some things for Dina and I got warm teeth. So everybody can have one. What's that? My first time using the copy machine. So it's a real visual language. We'll really see it big when we get to the Book of Revelation. It's like the Book of Revelation is looking at a big tapestry and just seeing the whole flowing story of what John's trying to write. And we're going to get some of that in here too. Daniel's prophecies are interesting because he looks at God gave him a vision, looking at things different than we look at them. Like we look at history as past, and we look at time as now. And we just see ourselves going through history and what is our limited field of view. Correct? God gave Daniel the ability almost to look down on history, almost to look at like a board with, I won't say a chess game, but with a story on it. He gave Daniel glimpses with the whole story. Beginning in, he got to see everything as it was going to happen. So that's kind of how apocryphal writing is. It's a huge storyboard. And God gave Daniel the ability to see it all at once. So, apocryphal writing is very interesting, and we have to look at it as without preconceived notions. And it's difficult to do it. Did anybody look at some of the ideas of the prophecies of Daniel from the last week that different people have? Yeah, it's interesting because we try. When I say we, I mean mankind, and people try to fit prophecy into their time period. Back in the 80s, when Reagan was president, he was the Antichrist, because his name is Ronald Wilson Reagan, 666. And so people claimed him as the Antichrist. People claimed, we'll see later, the kings of the North versus the kings of the South, in Daniel's prophecy of Russia and us coming in from the south through Palestine, and this, you know, there was going to be this huge nuclear war on the plains of the ghetto and armies clashing, and that's where the apocalypse and Armageddon was going to start. Didn't happen. Right? Now, people will look at different prophecies in Daniel. And they look at the statue that Nebuchadnezzar dreamed about, and the 10 toes, part of clay, part of iron, and it doesn't mix, so it's kind of weak. It has the strength of iron, but the weakness of the pottery. And people will say, well, that's the countries of the European Union. Now, they end up our time. Try to take it in, put it in. So we can make it fit here, make it fit there, make it fit there. I even saw a picture of the UN, some members of the UN, and then it was like Russia, the European Union are represented. I think it's kind of whoever else. And, the panel is the Antichrist. So we can't try to fit prophecy into what we think. We have to look at prophecy as God's before. So the Testament and other things about apocryphal writing. Another thing that God put some emphasis on. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead. Right. Yeah, there's always principle that can apply throughout mankind's history. Right? Because we are the same today as they were then. We're no different than they were as far as our humanity. So, and it is conceptual. And we're going to find a lot of things. I'm going to talk a little bit about numbers here, some of their meanings, and you want to sharpen your pencil. And we're not going to get real in depth into it, but I'm going to kind of give you some things to think about that we'll talk about later. Like some of the numbers, God places importance on. And he places importance on it at different times. There are maybe times, there are times in the book of Acts where it says, and we traveled 5 days to Troas. Well, what's the importance of the number 5? It's just 5 days. There's no real significance that God puts on it. But God says, they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. Why 40 years? Was there a purpose for that number? Was it just to wipe out an ungodly and unbelieving generation? Or was there a meaning ascribed to that number? Why 70 years of captivity in Babylon? Was that just a random number God put from the air? Or was there a reason for it? So we're going to look at some of those things. Right, there were. Sure. Right. Well, they were in the. Right. Well, they were. They were in the wilderness, but they spent 2 years at Sinai. Absolutely. There's always something somebody's not going to like, right? Let's see. So, for instance, the number 1, right? God considers that the number of unity. One faith, one Lord, one baptism. The number 2 would be the number of division. Jesus had two natures. I'm just reading what somebody wrote. Human and divine nature.
Okay. Also, number 2, because Jesus cannot be accomplished. So it's not 2 by 2.
Yeah. There's two testaments, man created male and female. Right. Number 3 is the number of divine perfection, the Trinity. There's 3 qualities to the universe. Time, space, matter, and each of those qualities has 3 different elements. Right? Time has past, present, future. Space has height, width, and depth. Matter is solid, liquid. So if we can see that our universe is divinely perfect, the way God made it. Right? The number 4, and this is going to be kind of an important one when we get in later into the prophecies, is the number of creation, the number of the earth, there's the 4 points of the compass, 4 seasons, we'll see the 4 winds, That's a pretty common thing. Absolutely. It's amazing how God's word is constantly confirmed
by things you see.
Number five is the number of grapes. The anointing oil that they would anoint the priests, they would anoint the priests in the fall and whatnot, is made up of five parts. So they consider that the number of grapes. Number six is the number of man. It's an incomplete number. Right? It's the number of not being complete. Man was made on the sixth day. We were to labor only 6 days. We'll see in Book of Revelation 666. Man. Man's number. And we'll get into the series of 666. I'm sure Mike would explain that perfectly. Number seven is spiritual perfection. There are 7 days in a week. There's seven colors in the spectrum. There, in the Book of Revelation, there were seven seals, seven trumpets. It's perfection, it's completeness. Okay, when I say perfection, I just want to.
Because all of our kinds of emotions are determined by the meaning of the year, the earth revolves around the sun, and the moon is because the moon revolves around the earth. It's not determined.
Right.
And so this place has a three-day week. And it's not true. People are exhausted. We didn't know quite how it can work.
When did the weekend come?
When did the weekend come? It didn't last too long. It was 10 years.
Wow, it lasted that long?
Yeah.
10 years?
That may not be.
So we would have another revolt?
Yeah. So it was there.
I wasn't going to go there. Yeah. The number eight is the number of new beginnings. There were eight people on Noah's Ark. Circumcision was on the eighth day. And God made eight covenants with Abraham. So when he was starting the new nation of Israel, basically, he made eight covenants. Nine is the number of judgment. There are nine Greek words derived from the root word for judgment. the root word is decay. D-A-K-A-Y. And I'm not going to get it. the gift of the Spirit are nine. There's nine gifts of the Spirit in 1 Corinthians 12. Word of wisdom, knowledge, faith, healing, miracle, prophecy, discerning of spirit, tongue, and interpretation of tongue. Number 10 is the number of divine perfection. There are the Ten Commandments. They tithed one-tenth of their income. There were 10 plagues on Egypt. There were 10 by 10 silver sockets that formed the tabernacle foundation. And there's 10 I am spoken of Jesus, spoken by Jesus and John.
There's another
document
here. Okay. And that is the number of churches.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire community.
Tantorin. Tantorin's with a statue. So, yeah. Absolutely. And I've read that in the press writing on my notes. Thank you. Number 12 is the number of governmental perfections. There are 12 tribes of Israel, 12 apostles, with 12 foundations in heavenly Jerusalem. There were 12 gates, 12 pearls, and 12 angels. So that's how God set up Israel. 12. 12 of them. Number 40, remember we talked about that one, was the number of probation or trial. So, Israel, in their 40 years of being in the wilderness after coming from out of Egypt, was on trial. They were on probation. And that whole generation, but to fail them. Moses was on the mountain for 40 days. For 40 days, Jonah wandered around Nineveh.
VeggieTales, tell him, stop flapping those fishes.
I love it today.
And Jesus fasted for 40 days.
Alright, so 40 is the number of
trials.
We're going to see derivatives of that number, or of these numbers. We'll see 7 times 10, we'll see 70 times 7. Remember when Peter asked, how many times should I forgive my brother? 7 times? And he's asked him completely. 70 times 7. Getting 400 men in time? No. The combination of 7 and 10 perfection. You forgive your brother completely and perfectly, just as God did. Okay. So, any questions, comments? Clear as mud? Make sense? No sense? Horse sense? Nothing else? Alright, now remember my rule for the class, you guys talk more than I do. At least as much. Okay. So let's go ahead and get into the text now. I think we're done with introduction. Is there anything else from last week, from Sunday, that anybody wanted to talk about? Discuss since I'm all wet on that. Really?
Okay.
Sorry. Most of the fun that Jim gave you, if he gave you one. Okay. Let's go ahead and read some text here. We'd like to read the first 7 verses.
Anybody? Joe?
Sure.
Thank you.
In the 3rd year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hands, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. Then the king ordered Aspenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court, and he ordered him to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal presence. Now among them from the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And the commander of the officials assigned new names to them, and to Daniel he assigned the name Belshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah at the governor.
Gerald got all the hard names right off the bat.
After a hurry, I said, okay, well, I get the vote.
Yeah. Why did I say yes?
That's what nobody else wanted to
say. Yeah. The old names are the hard names. Not everybody had a nice name like Daniel. So, third year Jehoiakim, right? We read that history back in the Second Chronicles. Fourth year, depending on who's counting. Jews or Babylonian, the Babylonian time of counting. Since you guys aren't here, Jeremiah says in the fourth year, the Jews would count from the beginning, if they took rank in the mid year, from mid year to the end of the year, they considered 1 year. Babylonians didn't consider it until a full year had passed. The first year was considered ascension, second year was considered first year. That's why there's a difference. The people say that Daniel's not true, it's contradictory to Jeremiah. So he's not. It's just the way they count the time. So, 605, 606 ish. I would say ish because years are an interesting thing. He's defeated. Nebuchadnezzar has defeated Egypt. They're heading back north because he found out that his father died and he had to go to Rome. So while he's there in Jerusalem, he takes captives. And he takes the nobles, the king, the royalty, the best that the land has, and takes them up there. So he pulls some young men. Most scholars think Daniel was between 14 to 20. You don't know, yes. The word youth could mean anything from the fire age, which some of the 3 years he was going to be from Daniel. So he's probably a mid teenager. 14 to 20 is the range that Daniel and his friends probably were when they pulled it. Notice verse 2. There's something interesting in there. It says, the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. Remember, well, what does this tell you about this? What's significant about that little statement? The Lord gave Jehoiakim.
He's involved, God's involved.
God's in control of this. What kind of shape at this time was Judah in? What kind of nation was it? Was it this huge, powerful, incredibly world power type nation? No, kind of like Hodunville, really. They weren't strong, they weren't particularly strong economically, they weren't particularly strong militarily. And what happened just a few years before, Josiah went out to stop Pharaoh. He got killed, they got beat. So they lost a lot of their military in that battle in the ghetto. The economy wasn't that good for them. They weren't doing well. Right? So, you think Nebuchadnezzar had no problem. So what kind of state that is Babylon? But anyhow. They're powerful. They're strong. They just became the world power. They defeated Assyria. They defeated Egypt. Those are the two world powers. Assyria number one, Egypt number two. Now remember, these battles have been going on for almost 2,000 years. When was Babylon founded? Right after the flood. Right? But I think it was Noah's grandson. Yeah, he founded and he got Nineveh. So, and it's been ruled by many people. A lot of people are taking it over. But right now, they are the world power. They just became the world power. So they're a very strong nation. But God had to give the hundreds of years. What happened to Syria when they came and surrounded Jerusalem? So that grabs an RM. You have Isaiah. He surrounded Jerusalem. It was going down. I mean, there were hundreds. There were at least 125,000 men surrounding Jerusalem. Nothing's going to stand up to 125,000 men. And what happened? Do you remember the story?
They never were able to go in and take them.
The Lord sends his angel and kills 125,000 men in one night. The Syrian, most powerful nation in the world, yanked the 10 northern tribes out, destroyed them, couldn't destroy Jerusalem. But God said, no, I have other plans for you. Right? If it wasn't God's will that Babylon took Jehoiakim and Jerusalem, it would not have happened. Amazing thought. If it wasn't God's will, the most powerful nation on earth at the time could not have taken the land of Jerusalem and defeated Judah. But he did. Because God said so. Because they've fallen into idolatry and refused to turn away. Scary thought for the nation we're in, huh? So this is a precursor, but our nation is in sore, maybe in sore trouble. See what the hell the United States is. God loves it. Nation drives, nation falls. See what happens, you just never know. And that, I think, is the beauty of the book of Daniel, the book of Revelation. No matter what happens, back on the third, as long as you remain faithful to God, you win. Alright? That's one of the things that I really like about this game. First page, continue on. So he picks these, the whole group of you. See, Tommy? Do you have something before you go on? Nope? Okay. So he picks the best you out of the group. He doesn't just pick these four. He picks a whole bunch of guys. Right? And he brings them in for training to be his personal servant. To serve in his court, serve him personally. What an amazing thing. Why would he do this? Why do you think he would do this? How did Babylon treat the Jews differently than Assyrians? What did Assyrians do? What was their standard practice for everybody to take? Things shifted up? Yeah, remember he took the people of the royal and the noble household out of the Jews. Big bronze fisher. Turn out the chief, there was no one king. And that's how he led, that's how the kings of Assyria led people out of their cities. Showing the common people, throw that up in quotes, that I won. Look at your rulers now. So what would they do with the populace?
Get people around to get their minds to be confident. And so the minds will be pure.
Right. Yeah, serious practice was to completely dilute nation. Right? So there was no national identity that any nation had. Not only the Jews, but any nation. They'd mix them all up. They pulled everybody out of Samaria, the 10 northern tribes, shipped people in, and they started mixing in. It was like they just made this huge melting pot. So there was no national identity for these people. Right. Yeah. Absolutely. They were considered worse than dogs. They were considered worse than the Gentiles. So Babylon would take people in communities, and he put them in certain spots, and he would give them communities. Remember what Jeremiah told them? Yeah, from Jeremiah 5? He told them, going into captivity to Babylon, because you haven't repented, but build houses, plant vineyards, prosper. You're going to be in captivity, you might as well prosper. And a lot of Jews did that, and they became rich. He would put them in communities and let them prosper. He didn't keep them down. He didn't keep them under his thumb. I mean, he did, but it wasn't like a serious thing. He allowed them to prosper in his land. Why?
Because he had to take action.
Yeah. They had to have, they would then have, so to speak, skin in the game. Right? It was in their interest that that long prospered. This guy was a smart man, and he did that. Later kings didn't do that. So, he was probably Babylon's greatest king. Belshazzar, as we'll see later, well, he was number two in the nation. Actually, he was number two king. His father was number one king. He wasn't so smart. None of them were. Nebuchadnezzar was the greatest king of Babylon. He was a very, very smart man. He wasn't crazy, and, you know, if he had godly manner, he would be, would have been a great, great ruler. But he wasn't. He was a great ruler. So, he brought these people in, and he also captured some of the vessels from the temple, and put them in the temple of his god. Why would he do that? Why would he bring vessels from God's temple and put them in with God's temple? Just for the gold and silver value? Trying to integrate them into his religion.
Right, and almost dilute the Jewish, you know, making it familiar enough for them to be comfortable and yet diluting it over time with
Okay.
I mean, imagine knowing about the power of the Jewish God. Could he have stopped it?
Could be. Probably. Then they've been some that were more prone, more accepting of paganism. I mean, they were there because of paganism. Worshiping the false gods is nothing new to these people, right?
And he probably was showing, see, your God did not come from my God. Right? So, I'm going to put your gods over here in my
right? They had, they were like the Egyptians, they were like the Assyrians, they had gods for everything. They had multiple gods. The interesting that the Babylonians and the Assyrians terrified of these gods because they believed that their gods were out to get them. They didn't believe that their gods were out to protect them and help them, except for the sea gods, because that's where the trade came from. And they're well, but they believed that their gods were out to get them. They put scary figures on either side of their doors to ward off demons, and so there's nothing to keep the gods out. They slither under the door and come through the cracks. And, but they felt that their gods were out to get them. So, it's crazy. I don't know why they would do that. So take these four men specifically and he gives them new names. Right? Turns them over to his head guy. In verse 4, these boys were youths at home whom there was no defect, so were good looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, you had ability for serving in the king's court. So, can't interview them and take the best looking and the most intelligent. And he's going to train them now for 3 years, feed them the best food right from the king's table. Talk about the best book they don't. Right? This is the young stuff. Right? Fat them up a little bit. And want to train them so they can serve him personally. In 3 years, you can end up interviewing. What do you think that might do to a young man? As far as how he thinks. Imagine being a young person and being handpicked between the president of the office, the president of Obama's cabinet. You are going to help him, advise him after 3 years. The training in the White House. How would you think about that? Coolest guy ever. You think you get pretty big head? I'm proud, puffed up. Big head, huh? Look at you over the rest of my life. They don't become arrogant about what is going to happen to them. Let's see. Okay, so not only were they to be inducted into the ways and the thinking of the Chaldeans, but they were going to be taught all the history, how the government works,
political system, the religious system. They're going to be taught everything because he, their purpose was to serve the king.
Right?
And he gives them their name. Why is that significant? Part of the culture, turning into Babylonian, trying to incorporate them some more, right? You still allow them to have a national identity, but we're going to give them different names. We're going to give them Babylonian names. So what does Daniel mean? What does Daniel mean? What does Daniel mean? What the
hell? God is my judge.
God is my judge. Okay? Okay, well, what will get with Belshazzar now?
Maybe protect the king.
Really?
That's what this says. So my friend, no, thank you.
Everything I've found, including this book, a servant of Bel, which was one of their gods.
But is that
Belshazzar?
It was a great reputation referring to the goddess Shechem Hanifu, wife of Marduk.
Marduk was their, what they considered to be their creator god. He was like, Duke. To that one. Okay. Hananiah?
The Lord is gracious.
The Lord is gracious. How about Shadrach?
I am fearful of the God.
Fearful of the God. Okay. Inspired by the sun god, apparently. Mishael?
Who is what God is?
Who is what God is, right? So, talking about how he has some of the aspects of what God is. And Meshach?
I am of little account.
Oh, really?
That's what this says. I wouldn't want that name.
Really? This one says here, who is what the moon god is?
Oh, how funny.
So it refers to the moon god, apparently. Azariah?
The Lord has helped me.
The Lord has helped me. The Lord helped. Yeah? And Abednego.
Servant of the god Nebo.
Servant of the god Nebo. We found one that actually agrees. Right at the end. Hey, so he was trying to incorporate them into their society. Giving them, taking away their Jewish names, giving them Babylonian names that refers to their god. So he's trying to kind of muddy the waters. And muddy the line between the loyalty without actually doing it like the Assyrians did. Okay, thank you guys. We will continue in verse 8 through the end of the chapter.